From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Wednesday, December 21st, 2016. And on this day, we'll look at how some Maine teachers are trying to teach students to discern truth from fiction when it comes to the news, and controversy over an invitation to new immigrants in one New England town. That's all ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Masters of Policy Planning and Management, preparing students to be a force for positive change in their communities.
Enrollments for Marketplace Insurance under the Affordable Care Act are up in Maine and the U.S. That's according to figures released today by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. In Maine, about 56,000 people have signed up. That's compared to about 51,000 at the same time last year. Still, Emily Brostick of Consumers for Affordable Health Care says she's concerned some people are not enrolling due to rising premiums.
Because people have gotten letters from their insurance companies that can sometimes be misleading. It makes it look like you're going to be paying more than you will because it doesn't account for the tax credit going up as well.
Brostick says there is also concern about the future of the ACA, but marketplace insurance plans and subsidies will be in place for 2017. And recreational marijuana will soon be legal in Maine. The recount on question one, which will allow possession and use of marijuana by people 21 and older, is now officially over, and the results are headed to the governor. Mainers voted to approve the measure, and in the next 40 days it will become law. But Maine Public Radio's Steve Missler says that will not be the end of it. The legislature now has 9 months to work out the details on how to regulate the new law.
Lawmakers are already talking about things that have to deal with a minor possession of marijuana, which wasn't intended in this, but there's some concern from the Attorney General that there's a loophole. And so you're going to see a lot of stuff in the legislature dealing with this, as well as dealing with edibles and criminal penalties. I think there's going to be a lot of stuff that happens in the legislative session and thereafter as the state constructs this regulatory apparatus.
And the legislature could delay that timetable if it sees fit. One of the biggest stories of this election cycle was the rise of fake news, false news stories that look real but are not. They often go viral on social media, and some say they helped influence the election. While many social media sites are trying to stop the spread, educators are stepping up as well. Robbie Feinberg takes us to two different classrooms to see how teachers are helping students differentiate between fact and fiction.
Have you guys heard this whole thing about Russia in the news?
Oh, no. Hacking.
At Portland's Lyman Moore Middle School, 6th grade social studies teacher Carrie Foster isn't afraid to talk about politics. Today she brings up a sensitive subject in the news, alleged Russian interference in this year's election, where the government hacked into private Democratic email accounts.
I also mean that they went on the internet and hired trolls and tried to spread fake news like we were talking about a couple weeks ago, like things that were blatantly untrue, in order to try to get Trump elected. You guys cool with that?
Yes.
Do you enjoy being lied to?
No.
Foster tells the students that this fake news is a big deal. These are false articles meant to look real, with widely shared false headlines about secret transcripts or candidates' connections to ISIS. To explain why this is bad, Foster makes it simple. This is lying, she says, with real consequences.
No matter if you like or don't like Trump, if you voted for him based on something that's not true, it kind of makes you feel dumb, right?
Yes.
So it's really important to actually be able to figure out facts.
Teaching kids how to do that isn't new for educators. Teachers have long emphasized the importance of hard facts found in books and databases. But now the internet has introduced a whole new sea of information. Foster says it's hard for anyone, kid or adult, to tell what's true online.
It's just really unhealthy and bad for social studies and democracy and citizenship and communities in general.
Foster's approach to teaching comes in the form of a little sheet of paper that she hands out to every student, stressing the difference between facts, opinions, reasoned judgments, and untruths. She then presents the students with stories, mostly from fake sites, for them to figure out what's true and false themselves. Foster advises the students, don't just read the headline, but the whole article. And she wants them to understand the difference between a website that anybody can make and a database or a fact-checked article.
Showing them where to find good information, even though some people find it more difficult and frustrating to do that.
The spider one really bothered me. The spider fake article.
In South Portland, the approach is slightly different. In teacher Julie York's computer science class, she tries to keep politics out of the discussion. Instead, she plays students' videos and has them create a library brochure explaining the difference between real and fake news. The goal, she says, is to show how this fake news affects real life.
I think once you get them to realize that it affects them beyond a research paper that they do in a class once a year, you know, I think once you get them to realize that, they start to go, oh, this isn't good, because I think nobody likes being lied to.
For students Jeremiah Sandville and Annika Savage, the class has made them more skeptical of just about anything online.
You gotta get multiple sources, a lot of sources that are actually good.
Or it's just everything's a lie. Everything's not real.
Yeah.
Nothing's real.
There's that, too.
Julie York and Carrie Foster admit that teaching this is hard, and both say they're not sure how much the message is sticking. But what may give their students a slight advantage are the laptops that sit in front of every 7th and 8th grader in Maine's classrooms.
Your laptops are having an important impact on students' ability to conduct research.
Donald Liu is a professor of education at the University of Connecticut. He's specifically talking about the Maine Learning Technology Initiative, the program started by former Governor Angus King 14 years ago that guarantees that every 7th and 8th grader in the state has access to a laptop or iPad. In a recent study, Liu found that with these computers, 7th graders in Maine were much better at researching online than students in Connecticut. This is good news, Liu says, and it shows that Maine students have a step up in digital literacy. But even though Maine students did better, it's tough to say they did well. An earlier study found that less than 4% of students can tell if an online source is reliable.
While Maine students are doing better, we really need to focus a lot more attention on online research skills and specifically in the critical evaluation of sources.
The state has invested some resources to improve digital literacy. However, wealthier districts like South Portland have an advantage because they can put more resources towards hiring dedicated technology teachers and integrators. Donald Liu with the University of Connecticut says that needs to expand to every district.
This needs to be our number one priority, because if we don't, we're really going to jeopardize our society. I mean, that's not an exaggeration.
Liu says it takes knowledgeable citizens to make the best informed choices at the ballot box. The first step towards getting there is by educating them in the classroom. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
In January, the first of more than 100 Syrian refugees will begin arriving in Rutland, Vermont, an aging blue-collar town of 16,000 people. The mayor has said the town needs an influx of new residents, but Rutland is deeply divided over the plan. Critics argue the city's too small to support so many newcomers, and they worry Muslim refugees won't assimilate and will increase lower local taxes. Some in the community hope a Trump administration will slow down or even stop resettlement. But proponents remain optimistic, and many have stepped up to ensure that the plan succeeds. As part of the New England News Collaborative series, Facing Change, Vermont Public Radio's Nina Keck reports.
For 2 hours on a recent Thursday night, Rutland's Unitarian Church was filled with an unusual sound, Arabic.
Masa al khair. Good evening. What would the response be? Marhaba. Yes, we have marhaba.
It's not a language you hear much in Rutland. There are few Muslims in the city, no Middle Eastern restaurants, and no mosques tucked between the many churches. Morgan Dennehy grew up near Rutland, studied Arabic in college, and spent time living in Egypt and Morocco. When he heard about the refugee resettlement plan, he decided to move back home.
I was really blown away by the amount of interest that people had for wanting to help, and I just sort of felt like I had to do my part. You know, that was always my experience learning Arabic or any language. You know, you address someone in their own language, it's just really powerful.
Since early November, between 15 and 30 people have been attending his free Arabic classes. Two Arabic language professors from Middlebury College drive down each Thursday to help.
Afwan, shukra lakum. I'm in Middlebury.
Adam in Middlebury.
You might be wondering, if Rutland is so small and has so little Middle Eastern culture, why bring Syrian and Iraqi refugees here in the first place? Well, compared to Burlington, where resettlement has been going on for decades, housing costs are low in Rutland, and employers have jobs to fill. And many, including Rutland Mayor Christopher Lewis, believe refugees will give the city a much-needed boost.
My response to people who say Rutland's not ready for this type of thing is, then when and how has this been working out for us? Not too well. Our population is continuing to decline, and we need an infusion of new blood and new culture.
Barbara Richter agrees. She unlocks a storage room in a local church that's filled with items donated for the refugees.
We have full sets of dishes. I mean, some of them are still in boxes.
Richter is part of Rutland Welcomes, a volunteer group that formed in April that now has a small army ready to tutor, mentor, and provide transportation.
With one phone call, I could mobilize a network of people to come in here and basically take what they need to set up a home.
Okay, welcome everyone. I'm so glad to see you all.
Across town, Castleton University's Emily Gleason greets 20 teachers and school counselors. Gleason specializes in literacy and cultural studies, and when she heard about Rutland's resettlement plans, she designed a semester-long course to help educators better understand the refugee crisis and the needs of refugee children.
We try to think about the kind of cultural barriers they might face walking into a small rural school in New England and how we can be as inclusive and as welcoming as possible.
Unlike many U.S. cities, Rutland doesn't have a refugee community already in place, so creating one has stirred up a lot of uncertainty. Jackie Gauthier, who's in the class and works in a local primary school, remarked at how difficult it had become to talk about.
I had one person say the other day, she says, I don't know why I feel this way because my family were immigrants, but I'm just not comfortable with them, you know, coming to our community. So she was struggling with her own feelings. She didn't really understand why she felt that way.
Many in Rutland, like Matt Howland, continue to have big concerns about how the city will absorb so many newcomers. While Howland applauds the efforts of local volunteers, he worries too much of the resettlement effort depends on them.
5 years from now, what resources does the city have in place to pick up if a group like Rutland Welcomes no longer has the means to help support this program going forward?
Roman Schmiakowski isn't worried. While not a refugee, he immigrated to Rutland from Poland 24 years ago, learned the language, and sent a daughter to law school.
You know, I look at mirror every day. I came here and I made it.
Schmiakowski teaches driver's ed and is developing a course to help refugees learn to drive. He says once they begin living in the community, he hopes people in Rutland will see them for what they are, other families just trying to make it. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Nina Keck in Rutland, Vermont.
And that's This Day in Maine for Wednesday, December 21st, 2016. Thanks to Ed Morin, Patty White, and our digital team. I'm Nora Flaherty.